I would hate to win the lottery, for instance, because then everybody would know that I'm only doing this for attention, because I wouldn't want to stop.
Hello, this is In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell, and that was the voice of today's guest, the journalist Zoe Williams. Zoe has written for several British newspapers and magazines, but she's best known for her work at The Guardian, where she currently writes a lifestyle column and a political comment column, as well as lots of interviews and features. I went to meet her at home in South London a few days before Christmas 2022 and found her recovering from a karaoke night out while making breakfast for her teenage kids and their friends. We went upstairs to the office that she shares with her husband, who wasn't there. The room is long and thin with tall windows onto a busy road, so you might hear traffic, but you'll definitely hear her Staffordshire Bull Terrier, who barked throughout in the background. We talked about working life as features writers, and Zoe told me about what it's like to have to conjure up political opinion every week, and also about the benefits and pitfalls of confessional writing, which she's done a lot of over the years. She's written about everything from her sex life to her parents' divorce to her experiences as a mother. If you've read Zoe's work, you won't be surprised to hear that she's quite frank in this interview. In fact, when she was telling me about the various times that she's annoyed friends and family by revealing too much about their lives, she said various things that I later had to cut out. So when she says, "Oh God, I'm doing it again," don't worry, because you're getting the edited version. She's brilliantly honest about the mistakes that she thinks she's made over the years in her writing and in her life, including her books Get It Together and Bring It On, Baby, which sadly she doesn't seem to recommend, although I suspect she's probably underselling them. Before we start, I'm delighted to say that this season of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency. Since they launched in 2011, over 180 of their students have gone on to get major book deals, including the critically acclaimed authors Bonnie Garmus, Jane Harper and Kirsty Capes. Curtis Brown Creative run a wide range of courses covering a variety of topics and genres. If you're interested in confessional writing like Zoe, you might want to try their 6-week online writing a memoir course with teaching videos, resources and writing tasks from best-selling non-fiction author Kathy Rensenbrink. Curtis Brown Creative have given me an exclusive discount to share with you. So use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of writing a memoir or any other 4 or 6 week online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. Now back to Zoe Williams, who mentions Marie Kondo early in our conversation. If you're not familiar with Marie's work, she's the Japanese author who is famous for teaching tidying methods and home organisation. And she actually came to Zoe's home and Marie Kondo'd her desk, but I'll let Zoe tell you about that herself. So is this the room where you write?
This is the room where I write, yes.
Would you describe it a bit?
Yeah, I will describe it. It's always incredibly cold, even in summer. It's got two big windows with box blinds, which if you close them, it gets a bit warmer, but then it's like a monastic cell. But actually, I don't really mind that so much. I've got a big roll-top desk, which my father gave me.
That is a beautiful object. I love that.
It was actually a cause of huge contention between my parents when they got divorced, and my dad ended up with it. I don't know how, because it was my mum's, and then he gave it to me just to annoy my mum when I bought my first flat. And I had in my first flat, my office was absolutely tiny, and all I could fit in it was the desk, and that was actually quite nice as well. That was quite womb-like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a fireplace with kind of Tuscan lemon tiles across the actual mouth of the fireplace. It's the most completely pointless object I've ever seen in my life.
So you didn't fill in the fireplace with tiles?
No. No,
and
I can't even think about what the thought process was. I think maybe to discourage fires.
Right. Have you ever thought about excavating it?
I don't know how you'd do that.
No, but it's probably not worth the trouble.
Probably a hammer would be involved. And then there are two big wardrobes, one of which are a little bit annoying, and they make the room smaller. But and then there's a sink in the corner.
Oh yeah,
which is like being at university. Like I find it really distasteful having running water in a non-bathroom. And then my husband has a desk in the corner as well, which used to be neater than mine, but since Marie Kondo came over to do my desk is now neater than his.
I can't believe you had Marie Kondo
in
here.
In my actual house.
You're the first guest of this podcast to have actually been Marie Kondo officially.
It was unbelievable. And it took her, and all she did was one desk, and it took her 3 hours, three full hours.
So what did she do? And what did you learn from that?
Well, she often says that... She often describes the experience of being Marie Kondo as quite profound, and I've always found that ridiculous. But actually, it is quite profound because you kind of go through your stuff. I mean, listener, you should look up the method properly rather than taking my word for it if you do want to Marie Kondo. But basically, you go through your stuff in a particular established order, which is clothes, books, paperwork, miscellany, sentimental, and then you just discard everything that it doesn't bring you joy. And like nothing, it turned out that nothing, look at my desk now, it's completely empty. I mean, nothing brought me joy, but she was showing me things that I was hanging on to. Like I had this Shrek album, like from the exhibition Shrek, which was, it was a really difficult time in my life. And I was doing it for work, and I'd taken my own kids and some other kids, and I was just about to get divorced, and I look crazy, and there's all these photos of like me and random children of other people's standing in front of an animated Shrek looking mental and like in distress. You can see through the photo that I'm in distress, and I was holding on to that for why. It was like, so yeah. She went through it, and I had all these memories like pouring over me, which were really horrible memories, like a tooth that my daughter had to have extracted at enormous pain to herself I'd kept. And then once you start throwing that stuff out, your tolerance for throwing stuff out becomes much, much, much higher. So now, like, I never used to be able to throw away underwear, which is insane. You can't keep it for 20 years. It's not made for 20 years.
Yeah.
But it's taken me this long to realise that. So yeah, it was really useful having Marie Kondo around.
When did she do that?
It was about, I don't know exactly. I'm a bit Rain Manny with dates. It was the 13th of November.
This
year?
Which
was a Sunday, yes.
Okay. Okay, I was going to say, God, and you've kept it going for all these years.
Oh, yeah,
but
no,
it's only
6 weeks.
Last month. Okay. I really struggle with throwing things away as well. And I think for me, a lot of the time, it's a guilt about throwing stuff into landfill. And
yes,
a lot of the stuff that I get rid of, there really isn't another option for it. And even if I wanted to kid myself by sort of taking it to the charity shop, I know that no one's going to buy it because it's crap. And I think that's quite a difficult tension between not wanting to live in a sort of hoarder's nest and also feeling really guilty about disposing
of
things.
It's a nightmare, and it's things like kind of headphones, gamers' headphones, and, you know, remote controls that don't work anymore. But you look at it, and you look at this kind of piece of hardware and think, is there something immoral about having bought it in the first place? But, you know, keeping it doesn't make that immorality go away. So...
No,
so just
it's too late.
It. Yeah, you
shouldn't have bought it.
Otherwise, you are effectively your own landfill.
Yeah, it's true. So do you and your husband use this room at the same time?
No, because his job involves him talking, having really, really boring meetings, which I probably could just zone out. But I think he feels very self-conscious if I'm in the room, because he rightly surmises that I would take the piss when he got off the call. So yeah, if he's at home, he uses the office and I just work in a chair.
And so what is this lovely painting above your desk, by the way?
Oh, that again is a legacy of my parents' divorce. My mum had a friend, he painted that painting of my mother. And yeah, again, it ended up with my dad because Andy was his friend and then he gave it to me.
Right. I'm impressed that Marie Kondo didn't make you get rid of some of these, you know, the desk and the painting, which don't seem totally uncomplicated emotionally, but
actually, I mean, yeah, you say that, but I think the animus of my parents' divorce was actually quite formative in a good way.
Yeah.
Wow, I've talked a lot about divorce in the first 6 minutes.
Wow. It's almost, it could go like, anywhere, this conversation.
It's almost like Christmas unearths these unpleasant feelings.
So what are the sort of, what are your favourite things in this room?
I really like this little chair. I've got this.
It's very sweet.
It's really sweet.
It's like
it's
a children's
super
chair.
Super uncomfortable. It looks like the kind of chair you'd put on a landing in a baronial hall. like for a maid to sit down on if she'd really been working her ass off. And yeah, I would never sit in it, but I do quite like it as a place to kind of store random objects. I like this little rug. There's this little kind of Berber rug.
I like this rug, yeah.
Which,
sort of cream with lovely bright colours on it.
Well, my husband went through this phase of buying things on the internet, and some of them worked out really, really well. Like he bought this, we just didn't have enough furniture because we'd moved from a place that was way too small. And we'd had to get rid of loads of furniture. We didn't have a sofa. And so some of the stuff worked out, but some of the stuff just arrived much, much smaller than he thought it would be. So this rug is like the size of a bath mat, and he thought it was going to fill the whole room. And he also bought a fondue set, which actually is like the size of a cup, and he thought it was going to serve 12. And the house is littered with failures of
tiny things
that he didn't take the measurements of on eBay, and that's one of them. Yeah.
Well, it is lovely. So, how do you manage your writing? Do you have a sort of routine? I mean, you're hugely prolific, so I imagine you must have to be quite disciplined about it.
No, not at all. No, I'm not. I'm just trying to think. I had another formative experience with a kind of lifestyle expert a couple of years ago.
This is the good thing about writing features,
isn't
it? It's
a great... I love features writing. Yeah. But I can't... it's so disrespectful that I can't remember her name, but I can't. But she was a time management expert, and she said, every single day you have to figure out how much time you've actually got, because you have to divide your day into buckets of time, because otherwise you're just freestyling, you know, you're just like you've got absolutely no way, no means of knowing whether you're ahead of schedule or behind schedule if you don't have a schedule. And that I found really influential, because previous to that I had just been freestyling. So now I definitely do think, okay, I've got 2 solid hours to do this, and then am I going to do it? Realistically, probably not. But you know, I don't have a very... I don't know how long does it take you to write 1,000 words?
Depends what it is. I mean, if it's like occasionally I write these sort of light-hearted opinion-y things for Times 2, and I can write that pretty fast, I could probably write that in a couple of hours and be reasonably happy with it. Whereas, you know, if it's something that's heavily researched or involves speaking to lots of people, or it's just something that I'm not that interested in, it might take much longer.
Oh, God. Something you're not interested in could take...
That's awful.
...a year. Yeah. I mean, it's terrible. But, I mean, I kind of find... So the kind of tragedy of my life, of my work, my working life, is that my job really, really hasn't changed since 1994, I would say. Like, I came out of university, I wasn't successful, but I did have a writing gig as soon as I finished. It was on this student magazine called Rasp, which was like spelt like raspberry without the berry, we used to say on the phone when we called people up and asked for free stuff. And I mean, I look at old copies now, and it was nonsense. It was all over the place. It was mad. It was like a fanzine. Do you remember fanzines?
Mm.
It was like a fanzine, but we were actually publishing it. And so from that point on, I've been doing the same job, you know, which is like, it's basically a little bit of confessional lifestyle-y writing, a little bit of political opinion, a little bit of interviewing, and a few think pieces. And probably the think pieces take the longest. And the lifestyle-y stuff I can genuinely knock off 1,000 words in 20 minutes if I'm doing...
That's fantastic.
And sometimes I have to hold it back, because I don't want them to find out how quick it was, because I think they're going to put my rate down. And then just before Christmas, I wrote this... They had this terrible idea because they wanted to get ahead on their issues. They had this really shit idea called a Christmas Present I'll Never Forget. And it tended towards these like really, really schmaltzy ideas. You know, I got a puppy and I didn't think my parents were going to get me a puppy, or my boyfriend gave me a, I don't know, a cake slice, and I realized he meant he wanted to marry me. So, you know, I was like, oh my god, this is going to be disgusting, this issue. And just to troll the editor, who I have quite a scratchy but fun relationship with, I knocked it off so fucking fast. It was like, it was in his... He said, what is the present going to be? And I said, it will take too long to explain. I'm just going to write it. And then the next thing he knew, like 12 minutes later, he had 800 words. And so... But, you know, I don't get faster. It's like with cyclists, they say it never gets easier, you only get faster. And actually, I think with writing, it's the same but different. It never gets easier and you don't get faster.
Well, you're already fast enough, I think.
No, because something like, I remember this piece that took me weeks and weeks and weeks once, and it was really early days at The Guardian, like 2004. And Kath Viner was still editor of Weekend magazine, as it was. And she wanted a piece on the arse in popular culture because everybody was obsessed with arses. It was like a kind of first wave arse fixation. But it's quite a difficult piece to write, that, because without seeming like prurient or prudish or lascivious or...
Yeah.
It's like it's actually quite difficult to
get the tone right.
Yeah. And also, it's quite difficult. You can't just pull all that out of your head. It's like 4,000 words. You can't pull it out of your arse. You need to get some experts, but how do you get what expert? Do you know what I mean? So it took me ages and ages and ages. Like the lag between her commissioning it and me actually delivering it was like 6 months. But actually, it would take me that, probably take me that long today. I would probably struggle exactly the same way today, even with like. The only thing that's easier now is it's easier to get people on the phone, because when you're just starting out, they have to really want to be part of the piece. Whereas when you're, you know, 26 years into the work,
they know your name.
8 years into the work, it's not even name recognition. It's not like I'm saying I'm really famous. It's more like, I don't know, you just blast in with a certain amount of confidence, you know. Mm. I know you're going to want to talk to me, because who wouldn't want to talk to me?
Yes.
And then everybody responds to that with, okay, fine, I'll talk to you.
Also, it's The Guardian.
Yeah, it's The Guardian.
I mean, I've tried...
Yeah, do you think The Guardian has better or worse brand, kind of, I mean, not recognition?
Oh, I think it has great, but I mean, it's internationally famous.
Much more international, yeah.
I mean, I've worked on... you know, some big name publications like Vogue, and I've worked on lots of what are they called, sort of corporate, like, you know, like called,
like trade publishing,
no. Yeah, well, not exactly trade publishing, but like I've worked on Tony and Guy magazine,
yeah,
which is a hairdressers
or
yeah, and that kind of stuff, and it's a lot harder to get people to help you out when you're, you know. And sometimes I've worked on, you know, maybe Vogue and Tony and Guy magazine in the same week, and the sort of marked contrast between how people respond when you contact them is funny.
I guess people just think this is like a corporate thing, so somebody's making money out of this, so why would I do
why would I help you out, and nobody's probably going to read it, so yeah. You write 2 columns a week for The Guardian, plus loads of other miscellaneous features and think pieces. Could you estimate how many words you write a week?
Probably a really bad week would be 2,000, and a really good week would be 10,000. And then most weeks are somewhere between that, more likely 7,000. Maybe 6,000 is probably right. Maybe I'm over amping this a little bit.
It's a lot. I mean, it's impressive that you sustain this.
I mean, it would be different if it was... I mean, imagine if you were putting that many words into, like, a sustained project of thought. I'd be like Proust.
Yeah.
Instead, I'm just doing this infinitely disposable content.
Well, I think as a journalist, you're in one mode. And you know, I know you've written books, which I want to go back to later, but... It's such a different mode, isn't it? Because when I've tried to write books, the idea of sustaining thoughts over the course of sort of 80,000 words is really intimidating to me, because I'm used to having a 1,000-word thought.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think it does actually kind of reshape your brain a little bit, having this. Because I have written books, but actually the problem with them has always been that they were too journalistic. And actually, people don't really want to. You know, if you want to read journalism in a book form, you just want to read a compilation, then you're kind of reading, and then you want to read somebody like Joan Didion. But if you don't want to read 80,000 words written like journalism. And that was definitely the mistake I made with my politics book. And I think to an extent it was the mistake I made with my baby book, was it was just too journalistic.
Mm.
And you just need to be a little bit more, you need to kind of flay yourself a little bit more if you want to justify the attention you're asking from people. I'm just saying, I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I'm trying to work up a proposal, and I always said I was never going to write another book because the money just doesn't make, it just doesn't make sense, you know. Even if you get a good deal, you're still making a quarter of what you'd make in journalism for four times the amount of effort.
Yeah.
But actually, I've got an idea I'm so into that I think I will do it. But you know, I need to go into it with a more mature attitude this time.
Okay, we're going to come back to that. What are your sort of first memories of being interested in writing?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I went on a school journey once to Minehead. And there was a massive, like, water disaster. There was a thing with, like, inner-city kids in the 80s where you'd get taken to Butlins off-season because you were so kind of lawless and you lived on council estates and all the rest of it. And it was, like, a really weird idea that we'd just be completely bowled over by the countryside. There was a kind of very big 80s thing that city kids were kind of separated from nature and denatured themselves by that. And so when you went on these trips, there was a huge amount of kind of botany and history, and it was quite boring. And it was like, not, we were like, this is actually genuinely boring. And we live right next door to Wandsworth Common. We've seen a tree before. And they treated us like slightly like wild animals, like we were going to start shooting each other. So there was a kind of permanent mismatch between who we thought we were and how the adults were talking to us, plus all these really, really boring events. But there was this really major drowning disaster near Minehead. I can't remember what it was called, or the place began with an L. And then we had to come back and write a report about it. And I did a report about it, and there was like there was a prize for the best report, and I did not win that prize, but they did give me a made up prize for the funniest account of the death of 98 people. And I was like, I mean, they genuinely found it hilarious. I wasn't even trying to be funny. And I did think, this is really, really pleasing. It's just very, very pleasing for everybody to be laughing. And even though, you know, I would be lying if I said all my output was that funny, I kind of did. It turns out that I do like the attention, you know.
And
I
would, you are very funny.
Oh, thank you. But not always. And like lots of misfires. But, you know, I would hate to win the lottery, for instance, because then everybody would know that I'm only doing this for attention, because I wouldn't want to stop.
Yeah, but you could say it was for the sort of deep creative satisfaction. You didn't have to let on that it was about attention.
And I always worry, like, you know, and you kind of have those, you know, what would I do if, like, I was widowed? And my worry with that, apart from, obviously, I love my husband, I would hate it if he died. My main worry is I wouldn't want to take that week off my column, but it would look bad if I didn't.
Okay, so would you talk me through sort of how that early exposure to attention and writing, then, you know, how you got into being a writer professionally?
Okay,
what was so your path?
I didn't do any journalism at university. I tried it once, and my dad broke the Official Secrets Act to send me some figures about, I mean, God knows the depths of delinquency of that man, but there was some figures about violence in prison. And I was doing a piece about prisons, and I just said, do you have any numbers on this? And he sent me an actual document with numbers. And then all the people who worked at ISIS, is that what it was called? Yeah, probably. Or Charwell. All the people who worked at this newspaper were such dicks that they spiked it in favour of some callow Etonian reminiscing about his, you know, about a rowing race And I thought, okay, I'm not interested in those people, so I'll just park that.
So, sorry to be dense, but were you at, did you go to Oxford or Cambridge?
Oxford,
okay.
Yeah, so it was like, it just wasn't my scene. And then what happened? Oh, yeah, then I came out and I got this job at RASP.
How did you get that? Just applying?
No. No, how was it? I can't remember. It was it was being sold to these Australians. There is nepotism in my story, but this is not the moment of nepotism. It was being, and the nepotism isn't that grave, but it was being sold, like it had been started by students, and it was being sold to the people who did TNT, that free sheet, and they didn't know anybody. So if they had known people, then they would have got somebody that they knew, right? But because they didn't know anybody, because they were in this kind of weird aneurysm of Australianness, they just asked a temp agency to find them an editor, and they were only paying 11 grand, so they couldn't find them a proper editor.
You were the editor?
Yeah, I was the editor. Well, it was your first job. Yeah, but there was only me and a designer, and we were, and it was really, really, really on a shoestring. But then the nepotistic bit was that an editorial assistant job came up at the Evening Standard, and my mum's lodger's best friend was hiring. So she just hired me. And that's how things went in the 90s. There wasn't really a process.
Yeah.
You didn't really advertise.
Secretly still how things work in a lot of places.
It probably is, isn't it? It's just the case of like, does anybody know a 22-year-old? And they're like, yeah, I know a 22-year-old.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So then I was at the Standard. There was this guy, and I worked for this editor who was like a horrible, notorious bully. And he tried to bully me out of it after he'd bullied like everybody. He was like really a vile, horrible man. And he finally picked the wrong target when he tried to bully Daley Thompson's sister. And she just brought an athlete's approach and took him down.
Great.
It was really satisfying. But then, so I started on this kind of side magazine that the Evening Standard had then called Hot Tickets. And then in the process of being bullied out, Nicola Gill, who now edits the Saturday Times, took me over to the main paper. And then from there, it was just fabulous. The Standard in the 90s was just amazing. Because it had four editions. So, you know, they never had enough copy. It was just like the teeth of a monster.
The Evening Standard, we've talked about your Evening Standard time before when I spoke to you for the article I was writing about Ladettes, because you did this column. What was it called?
It was called The Sluts Guide.
And it was about your
It was about my sex life. But you know, it's like now, a lot of people talk, you know, it's like when Bryony Gordon used to write her sex column, and it wasn't a sex column. It was like, oh, I've had a terrible date. And then this happened. And then this was a genuine like, oh, no, I've woken up in Tufnell Park and I don't know how I got here and who this guy is. It was like a genuine chaotic woman kind of thing. And and I was talking to the kids about Fleabag, and I said, I'm not blowing my own trumpet.
Were Fleabag.
I don't think that could have happened without who we were in the 90s. And Will went, that's right, children, your mother invented promiscuity.
So you were, at that point, you were writing about your personal life. You've continued to write quite a lot of stuff about your personal life, about your family.
Yeah, there's always
parenting,
like, there's a thing about, so I did the kind of slut column through to like the early, that only lasted till I went to The Guardian, and then I did kind of genuine general kind of rambling stuff, you know.
How old were you when you were doing the Evening Standard column?
I joined the Standard in 96, I was 23, and then I joined The Guardian in 2000, but I kept both of them up for a couple of years. And so then I would have been 27, I suppose. The Guardian had this really cool thing with me and Alexander Chancellor. So he was like the grumpy old man and I was the chaotic young woman, and we would do, and then sometimes we would accidentally do the same thing, like a hate column about Sue Lawley or something. And then they'd have to ring up, and I would always get binned because he was senior. And he was such a nice man. And anyway, so that went on for a really long time. And then I got a restaurant column on the Sunday Telegraph. And so they binned me off weekend. But that was like legitimate, you know. I really think this conversation's come up a lot recently with some high profile departures from The Guardian, because everybody's like, oh, they must have left because they're anti-trans. But it's really not true. It's absolutely normal for somebody to just get tired of you, and it happens. And it's just, you know, I get tired of people. It's like, I used to absolutely love that guy at the back of The Observer. I can't remember his name, which is fortunate, because I went off him like overnight. And that's just what happens with editors. So there have definitely been fallow periods when I haven't had a confessional column. I just do have one at the moment. Mm. And it's kind of more difficult now, because you can't really write about your kids that much. You can if they're really stinkingly rude to you. and then you feel justified. But you can't disclose it. You can't disclose much. You can't read the kind of thing that's going to embarrass them if their friends read it, because if, you know, one friend always will and show it to all the others. You can't really. So basically, you're reduced to calling your husband an idiot or saying something funny about your mother and hoping she's having a bad eyesight day. That's kind of it.
So that very personal stuff that you've written over the years, why do you think that works for you as a writer to be doing that?
I find it really, really cathartic. Like, if I have anything in my life that you know, I feel bad about, or I think I did wrong, or I mean, it's a sort of process of fucking up and atoning in public. And I just find like the crafting it into something readable and saying sorry at the same time is just I really enjoy it.
Yeah. This is probably too simplistic, but I feel sometimes that stuff is like a form of therapy, and it, like cheap therapy in a way, and that you get to sort of think it through, make sense of it, put it into words.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you can go really wrong with that. You know, it's like you can Liz Jones it and just be way too disclosing.
I love that Liz Jones is now a verb.
Yeah, I mean, I have done that in my life. Like, I had this blog for Marie Claire at the beginning of the internet, and I just was writing mad shit, like everything that happened to me, because it was really, it was like a lot. They wanted 300 words a day or something mental. This is before we really understood how the internet worked. And it was like there was this sense you had to fill it. It was like a void. It had to be filled. And I was writing really personal things. And then my sister got really angry with me, because for a number of reasons, and we had this massive row. And I was like, oh, it's just my process. It's my life. I'm allowed to do what I want. She said, who do you think you are? Liz Jones.
I was going to ask, I mean, how do you manage that stuff with friends and family and partners and
I've really fucked up. The times I've really fucked up in my life, there was that time with my sister, and it was a number of things. I described an argument I'd had with her in which she was wrong. She didn't like that. And I also called one of her friends crazy, and looking back, her friend was quite easily identifiable, and her friend was crazy. I'm doing it again.
Is there a sense of like, I don't know, is it to do with trying to work out what's your story to tell and what's not your story to tell? I've had a thing before where I've told a story to another friend who's also a writer, and then they've used that story in something, and I've thought, well, that's my story, I'm also a writer, so you can't use my...
Well, it's really funny, because when Brian Sewell died...
But I've probably done the same thing to other people.
I did a thing about Brian Sewell and what he was like to work with, and there was a famous moment when Tanya Gold, when she was in the kind of, you know, rock-bottom alcoholism, sat on his knee, and she's told that story before. So I thought, that's fine, that's public domain. And she's told it like really, really at great length. And I just mentioned it because I was sitting next to it. I was witnessing the event sitting next to it. And I was doing it as a character study of him, not of her. But she was incredibly angry. And I think one of her many, many points was that it wasn't my story, it was her story. And I actually still stand by myself on that, because it was my story in the sense that it was a thing I saw, and
you were there,
and I wasn't really talking about her. I was talking about him. So obviously, there's a kind of, I mean, yeah. Sorry, I've done it again, haven't I? You know, like rehashing all these times I've overstepped. There's probably going to be people saying you've done it again, but I think I interviewed Jonathan Franzen once, and when he'd written his memoir about his siblings, and I was amazed at how detailed he was, because I was like, you know, there's quite a few of them. It's like four or five of them. And I was like, you know, each one of them, this is kind of logarithmic. Each one of them is going to have a different memory, which is going to intersect with a different one of them's memories in a different way. So you are kind of accruing to yourself the power to tell it. It's sort of audacious. And he said, well, you know, I think we work from the presupposition that I'm not an asshole. But B, good answer. Let's work from the presupposition that I'm not an asshole either.
I don't know if this is too sort of pretentious or highbrow a take on it, but when I was reading over some of your old columns preparing for this conversation, I was thinking about that personal is political, you know, crossover, and thinking that actually your identity on The Guardian, or the identity that the readers consider you to have, does allow you to be saying something about politics at the same time as talking about, you know, having a child or getting married, or, you know, a lot of your personal columns over the years, I think, have said something about feminism or about, you know, class or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Yeah, I do think a lot of politics is sensibility, right? It's kind of, it's hard to explain. It's not that the question is pretentious, and frankly, no question too pretentious in my view, but it is hard to explain, because it's like, I can't imagine thinking the things I think about, I don't know, parenting, and being able to occupy a different position on wealth tax or, you know,
exactly,
trans allyship. It's just like they are inextricably linked. And I wouldn't, but what I wouldn't be able to do is take them back to the kind of root ethics that leads you to parent one way and say I'm a trans ally at the same time and think those things are linked. But they are linked. They are linked to me. I can't see how they would kind of shift. In terms of like my position at The Guardian, it's really genuinely weird that I'm like what I get away with. I seem to occupy this kind of space of like middle-aged womanhood where I don't, like, if Polly Toynbee gets a lot of hate and Owen Jones gets a lot of hate, but there's some kind of weird no man's land about the age I am, which is 49, not 50, where I, you know, neither the readers nor the kind of wider social media, they just don't seem to be able to place me, or I don't seem to stand for anything. So I don't stand for kind of establishment boomer liberalism, and I don't stand for Corbynista kind of poison, whatever people say about Corbynistas, and I don't stand for kind of centrist dads, and I don't stand, there's something weird happened where I just kind of got under the radar. I think it might be my cloak of middle-aged invisibility. I think, you know, I put it on, I thought, do I use it to fight crime or for evil? And actually, it's like, it's quite relaxing. You know, it's astonishing to me that the people would be sending Mary Beard like hate mail, but not me.
So
but
you
they
don't
I
get
never
that.
I really, really, really don't.
You don't get abuse on Twitter.
I got a little bit of abuse with when all of us fell out over Brexit. But actually, it was quite legitimate. They, you know, they like the really Corbyn hardcore were like, you're destroying the project. And I fucking was. I mean, in retrospect, I don't know what I would do differently, but what I did do didn't help.
What did you do?
Well, I was really working hard with this group called Another Europe Is Possible, and we described ourselves as hard left, hard remain. But what we did was create a lot of division within the kind of Corbyn camp, because Corbyn was, of course, becoming increasingly leavey. But most Labour members, you know, overwhelmingly, 83%, were pro-Remain. So it wasn't, so we were sort of sucking the confidence out of the left revival, while at the same time not really making any practical difference to the business of Brexit. But I don't know how you do that differently. I don't know how.
At least you tried.
I mean, we did try. Yeah, we did try. But I had this sticker on my computer saying "Hate Brexit, love Corbyn," and then I was in this trustee meeting with next to this Tory, nice Tory lady, and I was trying to get the sticker off because Corbyn had just done something really dumb and voted the wrong way or done something, and I was just chipping this sticker off really angrily, and she said, "At least you didn't get it as a tattoo."
Never get anything as a tattoo. How do you find it easy to generate opinion about politics every week? And
yeah, and that's a cakewalk. I mean,
are you a very opinionated person?
Yeah, really opinionated. The only time it's difficult is when something kind of manifestly bad has happened, and then you have to just say something really obvious, you know. Like, say there's been a disaster. There's nothing really to... Nobody wants to talk about anything other than the disaster. But there's nothing to say about the disaster except this is a disaster.
Yeah, there's no sort of fresh take on
it. Yeah. Apart from that, I mean, that's quite rare, thank God. Not least because disasters are terrible, right?
Yeah.
That's my hot take.
Yeah. Is there anything... You said you're working on a proposal for another book.
Yeah, I'm working on two things. I'm working on a screenplay, actually.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I know.
I was just going to ask you, is there anything that you haven't done that you want to do? And that might be one
Yeah, I'm
thing.
Working on a screenplay with Amy Jenkins, which is like really... It's just really properly weird because, you know, I don't really know what she's doing kicking around with me because she could do it on her own.
That's amazing.
She's Amy Jenkins. But we have a lot of fun, and yeah, so we're working on that. We're sort of halfway through a process.
And the way you talked about the books, I got the impression that you don't feel that they were personal successes in your
career. Oh no, they were terrible. They were terrible failures. I mean,
no,
honestly. So I wrote this book about politics called Get It Together. I'm not telling you that so that anybody should buy it because the writer is. It was the shortest window of relevance of any book I've ever encountered, because it's about kind of contemporary British politics. I wrote it, I've kind of delivered it in April 2015. It was written under the kind of assumption of perpetual coalition politics, and then Cameron got his outright majority in May. Also written in the presumption of the Labour Party always being a bit kind of limp-wristed and pathetic, and then Corbyn got in September, so it had all these kind of assumptions running through it of what politics would look like and how you would work towards a kind of radical transformed future around the Labour Party, and how you would work with a kind of muddling through but non-ideological government, which then turned out to be the most ideological government ever. And even though there were bits of it which I do stand by and I think would be useful, like there are bits about the housing crisis which are more relevant now than they were in 2015, nobody's going to go back to a book written in 2015 to find out what I think about the housing crisis. It was just completely completely missed its mark.
I sort of think that's on the publisher, though.
Yeah, maybe.
Let's blame
idiots.
It on them.
Well, they're the ones who paid for it, and they sure as hell didn't get their money back, put it that way. I got my royalties check and it was like 36p maybe. I mean, it's embarrassing. It's not even as much as half a postage stamp.
It's not embarrassing. Look at your fantastic journalism career. Is there anything you find particularly challenging as a writer?
I find it really hard to be dishonest, which is weird because I don't find it hard in my personal life. But I don't... Like, I find it really, really hard to say something that I don't really feel. So, you know, if you're kind of...
That's a plus, though.
It's not really, because often you need a kind of linking paragraph. So say you're doing an interview and you need to link from one thought to another, and the natural way to do it would be, after this excellent success, he moved on to that excellent success. I find it really hard to write that I enjoyed a TV show that I didn't enjoy, or really hard to write that a piece of work was meaningful when I didn't think it was, and like disproportionately difficult, because it's not the end of the world if I slightly over enthuse, but it sticks in my throat. And the same with politics. I find it really, really difficult to celebrate, you know, a kind of a kind of municipal boost to school meals when I think there's something a bit nefarious underneath it, you know. I think there's something unserious. When I think they're kind of approaching the problem of poverty in an unserious way, I find it really hard to cheerlead the kind of small fixes they make. But sometimes you need to celebrate the small fixes, and I find it hard.
Yeah. I think that's a bit, as an answer, is a bit like, you know, when in job interviews when they say...
Oh, yeah. My problem is I'm too conscientious. Yeah.
Your problem is you've got too much integrity, Zoe. Do you recall any moments in your career when somebody, perhaps an editor, has given you a bit of advice or a bit of feedback that has really improved your writing? Or maybe you've just come to something on your own and thought, I'm doing this wrong, and then found a much better way of doing it.
Yeah, I mean, everybody I work with on The Standard had a massive impact. Like Nicola Gill, as you say, she was kind of really good on the kind of you've got to just ask. So even though I haven't really taken that advice, she's very good on the kind of boldness generally. You know, you can't fluke it. You have to ask for the favour. You have to ask the question. Tim Lusher, who I work with on The Standard and who now is at The Guardian, but he's food editor, so I don't write for him very much, is extremely... He had a real... What's it called? A local paper background. He worked on the Plymouth, like classic entry into news journalism. And he said the best thing about being in a local paper is that you make your first front page mistake on a local paper, not a national paper. And he just really impressed upon me the importance of the kind of excruciating embarrassment of being inaccurate, which he would say I didn't take to heart enough. But I will say I would be a lot worse if I hadn't met him. Kath Viner is just, you know, she's got amazing, but you don't see much of it when she's uber editor, because she just doesn't have that kind of granular hands-on thing. But she's really, really good at zeitgeist, and you could just watch her for hours, like turning a few apparently disconnected thoughts into a zeitgeist thought. And yeah, Kira Cochran, I guess, is like, she's just got an amazing, like, she always wants more voices, and that I think is a really good, it's really good in features journalism to kind of, like, you know, if you've got five, how about six? That kind of,
yeah,
just one more voice. She wrote an amazing piece once about lesbians and later about people who came out late in life, like in their 50s, and it was just so jam packed, and everybody sounded so uniquely themselves that after that I really listened to her, and she was like, yeah, more voices,
yeah. And when you think about your writing specifically and your writing career, what do you feel the most proud of?
I really nothing.
Come on, Zoe, you can think
no,
of something.
No, genuinely, I just don't look at it like that. It's like I think of it as an exercise in getting away with stuff.
Are you proud that you've got away with stuff?
Yeah, I'm. Yeah. I mean, it's better to get away with stuff than not to get away with stuff.
A massive thank you to Zoe Williams, who I had so much fun speaking to. You can read her work most regularly in The Guardian. I'll put a link in the episode notes, where you'll also find that Marie Kondo story. Zoe also mentioned a time management expert who she'd interviewed. That was Julie Morgenstern, and I'm going to put that article in the notes as well. A reminder before we go of my exclusive discount code for the writing school, Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. I've done one a couple of years ago and really recommend it. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. If you're enjoying the podcast and you want to support it, then sharing it with friends or leaving a review on your chosen podcast app are wonderful and much appreciated ways to do that. If you'd like to receive my newsletter on the writing process, it's at inwriting.substack.com, and you can also sign up there for details of a live writing group that we hold a couple of times a month on Google Meet. That's all from me this week. See you next time.